The Tarncast, Tarncast. 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 It's the Tarncast, Tarncast. This is the Tarncast. Hi, I'm Andy Kamenetsky. This is the Tarncast. Some people may know me from my work and time with ESPN. I currently am on air with ESPN LA 710 semi-frequently. Some people may know me from weekly appearances on the Take Two show on KPCC or appearances on Time Warner Cable. I'm very involved in the sports media industry. Some of you may not know who I am at all. And that's cool. Same person either way. My guest is always on the Tarncast, Todd Robert Anderson.
Hi.
You gorgeous narcissist, you.
Hi. Hi. Wow, that was like out of the gate. I'm being accused of psychological disorders.
Well, you are the star of a podcast with only one star and one guest.
I guess that's... Yeah, that's
I didn't the say way. There's anything wrong with it. I'm calling it like I see it.
All right, so
and you and I have been friends for what, probably almost 20 years or something like that.
Has it been really 20 years?
We met. I want to say we met in 95. Is that when you got out here?
Yeah.
So it's almost 20 years.
It's coming up on 20 years.
We have been friends long enough that I can call you a narcissist.
What do you get a friend at the 20-year anniversary? What is like, what do you get? Like a paper thing? Like a silver? Is it?
I'm pretty sure that's scotch.
It's scotch.
That's the scotch anniversary.
That seems like every year, but okay. It's the
friendship is a very specific anniversary. It's pretty much... At least in our circle of friends, it's pretty much always alcohol.
Maybe we're all enabling each other towards terrible things.
I prefer to think of it as we are all giving each other a reason to live.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good reason.
It's a much happier spin.
To struggle. It's a good reason to go to the doctor so you can keep poisoning yourself with alcohol. I like that.
wanted to start out the Tarncast talking a little bit about, and I think it would make sense because, as mentioned earlier, I've been part of the sports media for a while. Mm-hmm. Your relationship with sports, because
okay.
It's not something I've heard you talk about before on the Tarncast.
No, nobody's brought up sports, I don't think, on the Tarncast. Yeah. I mean, I think that might have something to do with I don't really know that much about sports.
Well, I understand that. I'm not looking for you to break down last night's Dodger game.
All right, good, because I can't.
I know you can't.
No. Do you want to do it?
No. I don't want... Well, honestly, I can't right now because of the dispute that's going on between Time Warner and DirecTV for the Dodger station. I can't actually watch some of these games, so I literally... can't break down what
happened. Oh, okay, I see.
I don't get to see it.
Yeah, you didn't see it.
It makes for it's been an odd year this year. Unfortunately.
That is odd.
Yeah, I mean this stuff happens. It's not the first time this has happened. I mean, not to get pun intended too inside baseball, but the Yankees when they started their own station years ago, their own network, I think they lost a whole season because of disputes between carriers. The Lakers a couple years ago when they started their new one lost maybe about a month, but I think that the urgency, though, in L.A. for the Lakers, as much as, you know, Dodger fans are, you know, generational and loyal, it's a Laker town.
Yeah.
And it's a shorter season, and every game matters more, and, you know, you've got Kobe Bryant with, you know, only a handful of seasons left, so that got solved quicker. The Dodger thing has dragged on longer than I expected.
Okay.
But... your relationship with sports. Don't try to duck the question, sir.
You mean like my life?
Life with sports, like, current relationship with it? Do you...
Well, when I was a kid, I played sports because I grew up in a sports town. I, you know, played like baseball, whatever the... not Little League, but whatever.
Sure. We'll call it Little League.
We'll call it Little League. I know that that's like older, I guess.
You were not in the World Series.
I played Little League. I played soccer. I grew up in a soccer town, and I played basketball because I actually liked basketball because of the sports that I played. It was the only one that I had any real affinity for.
Right.
Maybe second soccer. I was terrible at baseball. It was just awful. Even when we were like doing like T-ball baseball where they I'd strike out with like a ball sitting still on a post at perfect hitting height. That's how bad I was at baseball.
That ball had a lot of stuff though as it was sitting on the tee.
Yeah, it did. It was
a lot of movement
me.
On the tee.
Yeah, it was mocking me and making fun of psyching me out. And I get like one of the thing like my nickname when I was a kid that started in junior high was, useless because, my friend, and I use that term loosely, John Dolly's mom, who was a piece of work, came to see one of the games.
A piece of work like Hubba Hubba or a piece of work like insane?
Like a bitch.
Okay.
Not to be sexist, but I don't know how else to describe her.
Plus you're a sexist.
Yeah, and I'm sexist. But she, I like had a bad game, and that happens.
Yeah.
And she's
even professional athletes, Todd, have bad games.
And she called me useless. She said to her son, her seventh grade son, on the way out of the game, as if talking about like people talk about professional sports that way all the time.
Oh yeah.
You know, armchair coaching and all that. You know this. What is it with this guy? He's useless. So she said that about me to her son. When we were in seventh grade, which that belies a certain character. But she said that.
Particularly in the formative years.
Yeah, she said that, and he brought it to gym class and said, yeah, my mom says you're useless, and everybody thought that was hilarious. So everyone actually started calling me useless. And that really got to me, and I got worse at soccer as a result. Like, became terrified of the ball and fucking up. I was terrified of fucking up. And I didn't have that problem with basketball because I had more confidence in basketball. But with basketball, just for the record though, we were playing soccer in gym class, and, another friend of mine was having a bad soccer game in gym class, and this guy, John, said, what are you, useless number two? You know, and everyone laughed, and I said, well, you're dickless number one.
Yeah!
Yeah! I got him! And then everybody was like, yeah! So,
still kept calling me useless.
No, the useless thing had stuck,
right.
And it stayed with me. It morphed through high school into use man. You know, went from useless to use dice, to use man, then back to use. so I was use. But it morphed from useless into like a cooler sounding nickname,
right.
Because I quit sports altogether and started acting. And then people were like, oh yeah, he's actually good at that. With basketball, which I really loved playing basketball, but it was either, you know, warming a bench on the good team. Cause my high school had a pretty good basketball team, won some championships and all that in the area we were in. But I was usually relegated to the like lesser team.
Right.
And I would be the best on that team, but in that, you know, that league, would be the worst fucking team.
It's the question of being the star on the JV versus, you know, the 10th man on varsity.
Yeah. And I usually chose the team where we would lose every game because then I would get to play a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's more, I mean, even if you're losing, that's a more fun experience for you while you're doing it.
Right. Like there was JV and varsity, but then there was like a freshman team is what they called it. So, and that
I was a senior
and that, no, I wish that was true. That would be funny, but you couldn't like, once you were not a freshman anymore,
right.
Once you were a sophomore, you had to go to JV. But after my freshman year, I stopped playing basketball and started doing theater all the time. So that was my last year of basketball, but I was on the freshman team, but we were in a really small town. So it was me and another freshman was all the freshmen. And then all the other kids were junior high kids, but we were playing freshmen everywhere else. So
right.
Like the you know, and some of these junior high kids were good players, but there was a size issue, you know, and a strength issue, and, you know, so it was a fun year of basketball because I was a loser and I became like a dirty player because there was
nice.
I would foul the fuck out of people's stuff. Like,
did you throw bows?
Oh, yeah. Threw bows, got in a fight almost every single game. I was like...
Really?
Yeah, I was like goon, like the hockey goon
basketball.
Yeah, I was like the goon because, the junior high kids had no shot of getting into fights. But yeah, like my coach would say, just foul out of this game.
Nice.
We just got to do as much as we can to stop.
I genuinely did not know this.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
And I want to say, too, by the way, for listeners who have not seen this, I've seen you shoot. I've actually seen you shoot, and you're not bad. I remember during your bachelor party, we happened to stay at a cabin, or like a series of cabins that had a hoop in the middle of it, like a rec area. And we played some, we didn't even play one-on-one or anything like three-on-three. We were playing like horse and
contests
like
horse,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
You could shoot.
Yeah, I can shoot all right. I mean, I'm like out of practice, but if ever I'm happen to be shooting, I need about 20 minutes.
Right.
And then after 20 minutes, you know, I'm shooting all right again.
Did you have an affinity for Bill Walton as a fellow ginger?
Well, yeah, no.
No?
No. I mean, I liked Bill Walton, and I was aware of him, you know. But I grew up in the '80s, so
right.
You know, my guy.
Well, he was part of the '80s Celtics team.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But like when I started going to games, he wasn't playing. It was Bird and
okay.
Robert Parrish
okay.
and all that.
Do you ever watch sports now?
No. I mean, I will if I'm in a friend's house. I mean, I'll go to like a
right.
Super Bowl party or whatever.
Right.
But no, I don't really watch that much sports. I watch hockey.
Right.
That's like the only game. And I don't, you know, follow it religiously or.
You have a beloved Bruins hat.
I do. And I watch some of the World Cup and shit.
Right. Well, the reason I got into this outside of just asking about some stuff that I haven't heard you talk about on the Toncast before is because I know as a moviegoer, and obviously everyone knows you are a movie junkie, this is your passion. One of the complaints that you often have about movies
mm-hmm.
is the predictability to them. And
sure.
how a lot of them, you can see everything coming, you know, an hour before the ending actually happens. And,
that's
you
true.
Know, that can ruin the entertainment value for you. Sports is actually one of the things where, you know, obviously there are some outcomes you can see before they happen.
Mm.
But there's an unpredictability to sports.
Yeah,
that's
true.
That's baked in. That to some degree, I think if, say, there was a sport you could find yourself enjoying and keeping up with, that element of entertainment is there for you that may not be found for you right now in movies.
I see what you're saying. And certainly, I think with basketball and hockey, I can, you know, invest into a game. I don't have any connection to... You know, I mean, I grew up going to Celtics games, Bruins games, Red Sox games, and Patriots games because my family
right.
were all Boston sports fans. And there was like and my friends too, and there, you know, there was that sense of
Boston's a sports town.
Hometown pride. But having left there, like in moving, like I just didn't maintain that feeling. And I don't know, I think there's an element of, because, you know, professional sports has changed so much, and it's such a corporate...
Yes, it is.
Like, a corporate event.
Yes, it is.
And the money buys the best players, regardless of where they're from. Like, if I lived in Ireland, let's say, I think I would be a hurling fan.
Okay.
I think I would watch hurling. And I think the reason for that...
For the people who don't know what hurling is, explain that.
Hurling is an Irish game, and it's like, how do you explain it? It's like, it looks like a soccer field or an American football field. Actually, it's a combination of both, because there's like an American football field goal, and then under it is like a soccer net. And then there's a little ball, and if you get the ball in the field goal, you get a point, or if you get it in the net, the soccer net, you get 2 points, and everybody has these sticks, and you can run with the ball for 3 steps. I may be getting this wrong, but I think I'm right. Run with the ball with 3 steps. After that, you can balance it on the stick, bounce it or pass
right.
it or
okay.
whatever. It's rugby-ish sometimes.
So it's like rugby lacrosse?
Almost. Yeah, it's like rugby and lacrosse. It's very violent. It's like hockey-esque in that there's a lot of missing teeth.
Well, you love violence.
I do love violence.
So this is in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, it's in my wheelhouse. Controlled violence.
Right.
But
practical violence, not CGI violence.
Not CGI violence. Yeah,
it's got to be the real violence. Thing.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Well, it depends.
Controlled.
It depends. Real. I can watch a Deep Rising with Treat Williams. That's CGI violence. It depends on the tone of the picture.
I don't want to mischaracterize you.
But the thing that's interesting about hurling, and they have their stars, and they have their stars who get their like ad campaigns in Ireland selling whatever, Guinness or Murphy's or something. But the thing that's interesting is none of them are technically professional athletes because none of them get paid to play.
Huh.
And they're all from their county. Like, you know, each county has a team, and those are the – so there's a real sense of hometown pride, and these guys are playing to play.
It's a community feel.
Yeah, and it's a fast-moving game, too, unlike baseball and American football, which both of those things stop, you know, for long periods of time for chattings. And
right.
That way, you know. So this is more like hockey. So I think if I was there – and I, you know, lived in a, I think I'd probably be more likely to get into that.
Now, your son, do you care if people know your son's name?
No.
Colby.
Colby,
I
just
wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
How into sports is Colby?
Well, he...
I know he does the martial arts.
Yeah, he does martial arts and swimming.
Right.
Those are his sports currently. We want to get him into a team sport. We think that would be good for him at this point. And he... is sort of leaning towards soccer. He likes playing soccer when he has little pickup games with his friends. So, you know, maybe soccer. And he likes watching soccer. He also likes hockey.
Right.
He likes watching hockey. But because we don't follow it, you know, religiously and know, you know, I mean, he'll watch a hockey game and enjoy it, but, you know, he doesn't know what's going on or who the
stars are. Does the idea of being a team dad appeal to you, or does that sound like the worst thing in the world?
That sounds really awful.
That, by the way, is the correct answer.
Yeah, that sounds awful. I don't, you know, my wife, God bless her, is a second grade teacher. And when I walk into her classroom and see her handling these 20, 22 second graders, I'm in awe of it. Because I can't, like, it's, a couple times she's, you know, pulled a fast one. It's like, hey, can you just hang out with the kids and, you know, talk about your acting? I got to run next door. And, it, you know, it'll be like 3 to 5 minutes.
And by next door, I mean I'm leaving.
It'll be, well, she'll have to go get something, you know. So I'll be there with 20 kids, like, all, like, asking me about, like, vamping. I saw you in this commercial. And I'll be like, I don't do well with large groups of kids. And when Colby has like birthday parties or we go to birthday parties, like when we go to birthday parties, I can kind of handle that because then I'm just sort of responsible for him. But it's still the whole thing makes me nervous, you know, because the kids can get out of control at any moment.
Well, the worst part is if you're the team dad is the parents who get out of control.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's bad.
I mean, that you know, I can only picture your reaction and how bad it would be if some dad starts flipping out because Colby allowed a goal to get through and starts screaming at Colby. That's going to be ugly.
My dad, when I was growing up, and he coached a little bit too. He'd like fill in for coaches on my basketball teams and, you know, when I was smaller, mm-hmm. And coach soccer a little bit and all that. But he would get into it with any parent who started that. He
Good.
Would get into it. And there was one time where – and I got made fun of mercilessly by my friends for this. But, you know, I wasn't mad at my dad. I think, you know, he did the right thing. But there were, like, kids who were – they were getting into a fight in the middle of the soccer game, like fisticuffs. And the ref wasn't doing anything about it. You know, nobody was doing anything about it. So he charged out onto them and tore these two kids apart and said, stop it. And then the ref was like, what are you doing? And he's like, what are you doing?
I'm reffing.
Yeah.
That's what
so
I'm doing.
So he's yelling at a ref. And then, like, one of the kids' dads who was, like, off on the side was like, you know, mind your own business. And he's like, what? You can just let these children kill each other? come on, you know.
This isn't the Hunger Games.
Yeah, so he was like the voice of reason a lot of times in those situations. And I'm sure that's what I would be if I was, but I wouldn't want the responsibility of coaching children.
No, I could see that seriously get, I mean, and I think about that, you know, with my daughter and if she plays sports, and I'm hoping it might be a little more mellow coaching a girls team just because, you know, for whatever reason, whether you want to say it's, you know, baked in sexism or the money generator, just, you know, interest girls tend to gravitate towards or whatever. There's less of a priority placed on girls' sports than boys. So maybe by extension, the parents would end up more mellow about it than if, say, I had a son and my son was playing on the team.
Right.
But I imagine that parents probably go aggro regardless of gender. And it can get really, really ugly.
Yeah, I'd imagine that they get as invested. Well, I mean, and now there's like a star little leaguer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Monet Davis.
Yeah. That's an awesome story.
She can throw. Wow. She can. I mean, she had some trouble down the stretch as the series kept going on. But man, that girl can throw.
Yeah,
I mean, she was throwing like 70 miles an hour or something. Like if I tried to throw 70 miles an hour, I would end up pulling my shoulder out of place before I actually probably hit 50.
Right.
I would
amazing.
Kill myself trying to do that.
That's amazing.
Moving away from sports and into acting and career.
Uh huh.
What drives you to keep going with acting? Because I know from, you know, knowing you personally, knowing you for a long time, there's frustration a lot of times in in the way things go.
Mm-hmm.
What drives you to keep going?
Oh, it's funny. My son asked me the same question the other day. He said, "Hey, Dad, do you have to be an actor?" And I said, "Well, no, but I need a job, and this is the job I chose." I think, like, at this point, what drives me... Well, I mean, at this point, I'm kind of... You know, I went through an embittered phase, you know, when things got really slow. And, you know, and I don't understand why people like Tara Reid have career. You know what I mean? It's like when talent...
I thought your embittered phase lasted about 20-something years.
Well, I've gotten a lot less bitter. I mean, I very rarely criticize actors anymore.
Right.
I throw out the Tara Reid example because she is egregiously terrible.
Well, I'm not really sure she's an actor.
Yeah, well, I'm there's that element of
right.
it, you know. But I mean, I think what drives me now is just the fact that there's nothing else for me to do, and I don't want to go back to college at 42 years of age. I don't have that kind of discipline. I don't want to do it.
I had fun for most of college. I wouldn't want to go back at all.
No,
I don't miss that at all.
I loved college, but I mean, like, now it wouldn't be for fun.
No.
It would be actually to learn a new skill, and the concept of, at my age, starting a new job. People do it all the time. I mean, my in-laws did it, quit acting, and became therapists. You know, people
right.
do it all the time. But like, that seems like really hard. Like, what they had to go through to get their licenses is insane.
No.
And then you're starting a whole new job, and that like kind of concept, it terrifies me. So what drives me, I think, ultimately, is just not wanting to get a job.
How much of what got you into acting and wanting to be an actor in the first place, how much of that still exists in terms of a driving force, if at all? I mean, because you've had the reason I ask is you've had a long time to really learn the reality of the business and how the sausage is made. And whenever you do anything long enough, you know, I mean, it becomes different. You know, it becomes a very different animal once you really see how a lot of things work.
That's true. And also, you know, the showbiz, Hollywood has changed and evolved so much with technology. You know, I think part of my frustration is that, you know, I sort of came in at the wrong time,
yeah,
kind of thing for what I wanted to do. But I would say that the stuff that inspired me when I was a kid is still stuff that I try to do just in my own little way.
Well, I mean, that timing element, though, is really important. I mean, I know we've talked about before, you know, the original film pigs, the stage version of it, when, you know, not what it's evolved into now with you and the Steves, or, you know, the film version of it, you know, more of commenting on movies. What we originally used to do was, you know, improv version of actual movies,
right?
Like parroting movies. And we did that in the mid-90s, and, you know, I was a part of that group. If we had been around when YouTube was around and the internet had really exploded,
yeah,
I'm not saying, you know, we automatically would have been huge or anything like that, but that's an advantage that could have really helped us.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
That's a tool that really, particularly for what we were doing, would have been, it could have been a game changer.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
It certainly could have put us in a better position.
Yeah.
I mean, because a lot of people started doing things like that afterwards, you know, using YouTube and using the net. And we, you know, we were trying to do grassroots when grassroots really was grassroots.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I don't know. I mean, it's like, who knows what, but that's true. I mean, I think that, like, and now certainly there's so, I think we were early with the irony too, like that, doing that kind of parody. Not that that hadn't happened before. I mean, in my whole concept of the film pics when we were doing stage versions, it was just Airplane.
Right.
That's what inspired me, to do it. And we, you know, didn't have money to make feature films. So, but we could get onto a stage in some shitty theater on Santa Monica Boulevard.
Which we did. All of them.
Yeah. With little, most of those theaters we used, you know, with a few props and just be dumb for an hour.
And most of our budget was alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. Most of it was, we spent most of our money on beer. But yeah.
That's not hyperbole, by the way. That really is what we spent most of our
budget. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the occasional, you know, Speedo and maybe a vegetable of some kind to put in the Speedo. But yeah, I mean, if our timing had been different, it might have been different. You know, we may have, it may not have just been Stallone's White Eagle Productions that optioned us for a dollar. We may have had more people competing to get us to do, you know, what we wanted to do was take it to another medium.
We could have had competing $1 bids.
We could have. A lot of people could have been willing to give us $1.
How great would it have been if it was all the cast members of The Expendables, all like Stallone and Gibson and like Dolph Lundgren and all these different people? Because, you know, Stallone, this is a true story. Stallone's production company actually optioned us.
Right.
However you option people for,
well, they optioned the production, the show.
Right, the show for $1.
Right, because legally you can't option something without money changing hands.
And so then they turned around and did nothing with us, and eventually the
They set up one show for Universal executives. The show went really well.
It actually did go well.
It was like that show, I think, was our, and we always did well, I think. I mean, we had a couple of shows where there was too much beer and things went south, but usually we had a fun show. And at that point we were always selling out people, but that, like, theater was packed and people did not stop. There was one segment of it where we said nothing. We were waiting for the audience to stop laughing, and it would, went forever. So my assumption after that show was like, how could they not love us? But the Universal executives, especially the main one who was there, whoever he was, hated it. Fucking hated it. Was like, why did you waste my time? Like ripped into Stallone's guy about making him come to this shitty theater and watch this dumb show. And but then I had a friend who worked with him and was at a board meeting the next day, and he used like four or five of the jokes we made in our show to get laughs in his meeting from a show he hated. But because of that, like, extreme reaction, Stallone's guy just immediately gave up. But that's like, that happens all the time in Hollywood. Like, one negative thing and like they get terrified.
Well, it's so risk averse.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And they don't want to, he doesn't want to get fired by Stallone if it's bad enough that this Universal guy is going to call Mr. Vanny Arms and say, what the hell is your guy doing to me, sort of thing. And then Stallone's going to give him shit, but he doesn't want to get fired, so he's going to let it go after that.
It's interesting, too, like, because this improv background that I have that really you introduced me to, because, you know, the Pigs were in existence, I guess, about a year or so, and then you brought me into the group.
Yeah.
That improv background has ended up helping me in radio a ton, because it just drills into your head the concept of thinking on your feet, listening, and dropping agenda. I mean, there's been so many times where, you know, I mean, I go into interviews. I mean, even now, you know, I've got stuff listed, questions to ask and that. But you end up, because of improv training, or at least I have, discovering better questions to ask. Or, you know, you're about to go somewhere and you go, oh, wait, hold on. He just said something. You know, stay with this.
Right.
And, I mean, I really feel like improv can help just about any profession or occupation on the planet.
Yeah, the whole simple kind of improv, Second City improv philosophy of yes anding, I think, can help in any situation, social situations too. Because, you know, it's easy when you're doing radio stuff or podcasting and all that, and you're having a conversation on mic, if you're agenda driven, then it's going to wind up getting clunky and weird. Like, if you're trying to get to some particular thing, it's going to wind.
The bits build up in your head, and you're going to make sure you get to that bit no matter what ends up saying. That punchline becomes so important to you. You sacrifice everything, you know, that's led up to it, but also what's coming from there, because you had to work in that one joke.
Right. And often in working in that joke, you derail whatever your bit you're doing, because it was going in a more organic direction towards something else. And if you just stuck with listening and responding, then you would have had a great bit. But if you force a joke into it, often that joke won't land.
What would be the ideal film career for you, the ideal acting career for you? Like, if you had to pick an established actor and say, I'd kill to have his career, who do you think it would be?
Like, currently?
Currently or in the past? I mean,
well, I mean,
if you could parachute yourself into a career right now, like into somebody's career path, like something that you mirror theirs.
Well, I mean, either early Steve Martin, 1970s and 80s Steve Martin, Or 80s Michael Keaton, really.
Right.
Because, I mean, Steve Martin's early stuff, it was very absurd, and I like that kind of comedy. And I don't think there's enough of it anymore. Like, everything is so – people are so hell-bent on reality, quote-unquote, and making things seem more grounded. And then it's more relatable. And, you know, and I think there's a corporate point to that, because certainly Steve Martin, what killed Steve Martin was money.
Right.
Father of the Bride, which I thought was an absolutely atrocious movie, except for a couple of, like, Steve Martin-y moments. The whole movie was so saccharine sweet and pointless, and just, like, about white person. I'm not even going to call them problems, because if you're, you know, your whole thing is getting married and that's your stakes, it's fucking boring. I mean, Weddings are cool and fine and can be romantic, but it's not a movie.
Well, I mean, I think what they were trying to do, and I mean, I'm sure you would say they didn't succeed in it, but what they were trying to do was relate, you know, that relatability, that universal relating back to the issue people always have with getting married, with the budget of the wedding. You know,
right,
because that's something that a lot of couples end up arguing over, or like one family wants to go bigger than the other. And like you said, there's this inherent desire by studios and by, you know, companies making movies to make sure you can relate to something or that audiences can relate. And a lot of times I agree that my big fat Greek wedding, which I hated,
horrible.
I know everybody I know who loves that movie. What they always say is, well, my family's just like that. So I understand.
Yeah, my response when I hear that is, I'm very sorry.
Well, my thing is always just, you know what, maybe you can see your family and then that's great. But it's like, I know what, you know, my family, I don't consider like my big fat Greek wedding family. But it's like, I don't need to go to a 2-hour movie to watch my family. I can just stay at home with my family.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I like
movies to transport me somewhere else. Like, I like... Like, if I'm watching dramas, I don't want to see a drama about a wedding. I don't want to see a drama about middle-class white people going through a wedding shit.
Well, I think I like when you see movies that have, you know, universal truths or universal themes that can sort of – that can span different backgrounds, you know, whether you're talking, you know, racially, ethnically, socioeconomic, like things like that. You know, that type of universal, you know, universal relatability I think is great. But when it's just literally, okay, I've been in that situation before, it's like, the hell do I need to watch that for?
Well, and to be specific about Steve Martin, you know, after Father the Bride, made four times what any of his other movies made. Even though, you know, things like The Jerk, you know, and
The Man
LA
with
Story,
Two,
you know, are considered classics. I think The Man with Two Brains, which I love, is not like necessarily a classic. It's more
okay.
of a
All of
you
Me.
Know Steve Martin completes, but All of Me,
All of
Me's yeah,
fantastic.
Certainly. And
Three Amigos.
I love Three Amigos. Like, and we lost that Steve Martin, the Steve Martin that was writing that stuff, that absurdity. And maybe he was just done doing that, which is an understandable. I mean, but. You know, I would have liked to have seen that writer, actor, Steve Martin evolve more as a filmmaker. Cause now right. it's like, you know, he does the Cheaper by the Dozens and the Bringing Down the Houses. And these movies make way more money than any of his artistic cinematic ventures ever made. But
I mean, I'm trying to think of what of Steve Martin's, you know, after that Father of the Bride moment in his career, like what he did afterwards that he was involved with the writing that really reflected him, other than Bowfinger.
Bowfinger's it. That is it. The rest
Bowfinger's
of it,
great.
The rest of it, no. I mean, like, he made his Shop Girl movie.
Right.
Which, you know, I thought was kind of flat. But at least he was trying something. But I think more like his, when he writes for The New Yorker, I think there's more art in his essays.
Or in his banjo
and his
work.
Banjo playing than there is in his movies. But I like movies more than essays and banjos. Essays and banjos are fine, you know, but I wanted that Steve Martin to evolve. It would have been more interesting to see him evolve as a filmmaker.
It's interesting, too, that you say Michael Keaton in the 80s, who, and I'm a huge Michael Keaton fan.
Yeah, Keaton's great.
But I've always felt that Michael Keaton, probably more than any other name actor, is the actor that Hollywood couldn't figure out what to do with.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, or at least I've heard before, he can be, or used to be, a little bit difficult. You know, it wasn't always easy to work with, you know, and some of this, I'm sure, comes down to his own choices.
Mm.
But I feel like Hollywood always had a difficult time just figuring out what do we do with Michael Keaton. And it's interesting, given sort of what you want from Hollywood and how much, you know, your own taste you would want to bring into it, that you would pick a guy that Hollywood had a difficult time pigeonholing.
Well,
or not even pigeonholing,
but
using.
But I think that's it. And I you know, I don't want to be immodest, because it could just be that I'm not that good. That's a total possibility. But I mean, I think that I'm not pigeonholed necessarily. I think I have a little bit of a range. And I think being pigeonholed in Hollywood can be great for a career monetarily. And you can rise to stardom if you have, like, sort of one thing.
As long as you're pigeonholed right. I mean,
right,
Alec
right.
Baldwin's film career almost got crushed because they were trying to pigeonhole him as a leading man. And that's
Yeah, that's a tricky thing. And then, you know, that I think that happened to Jason Patrick. And well, these guys are also drunks. they're like curmudgeonly drunks who get in fights with people. So that could be part
sure.
of it, the problem. But I agree with you. I mean, I think you do have to be pigeonholed right. But what's interesting about Keaton, even though, you know, all of his comedy movies didn't necessarily work, he was always good, you
yeah.
know, even in like Multiplicity, which is kind of,
okay.
It's up and down. It's mediocre, but he's great.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He's great. And he's playing off himself in these scenes, especially when the really dumb one, the copy of the copy gets
introduced. He's either playing off himself or playing off Andy McDowell, which is pretty much playing off himself.
Right, right. Exactly. So, I mean, and also, like, if you look at what he did, like, sort of started in this comedy realm, you know, with Night Shift. And he was doing comedies. But at the same time, he was doing, you know,
Clean and Sober.
Clean and Sober. He was The Batman.
Pacific Heights.
He was, well, sure.
But I mean, but he in was terms playing, of showing
in,
range. Sure,
yeah, in range.
It's not a good movie.
No. It's kind of a fun, you know, guilty pleasure thriller and like one good cop.
Right.
And shit like that. Like, he was going all over the place. And I think that's what any actor ultimately wants, is a shot at doing all these different things.
But that's what make, I think for Hollywood, the more range you show, particularly in the way Hollywood's evolved, like it wasn't necessarily the same way when De Niro and Pacino and Dustin Hoffman showed range, you know, because it was just a different time in movies.
Yeah.
But for a guy like Michael Keaton, the more range you show and the more talent you show, often I think Hollywood, it just makes it harder for Hollywood. I think Woody Harrelson had that problem.
Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of people still have that problem. But Hollywood's also, you know, there's the difficult, like, I, you know, there's, when you hear stories about actors being difficult, there's like different versions of it. There's difficult because they have a personality disorder, sort of difficult.
Right.
And then there's creative difficult. There's like sticking to your artistic guns and trying to figure things out. And sometimes you're combative with people. And when people are dealing with a movie schedule and like they need to move it along and you're holding it up because you think this doesn't work this way.
It's Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie.
Right, right, exactly. So that's a different kind of difficult.
Both in Tootsie and apparently while making Tootsie.
Well, Hoffman was known for being difficult, but I think his difficulty was not, you know, like
he wasn't being a prima donna.
No, he wasn't like high on drugs, you know, and being all over the place. And I think that exists too, or having untreated bipolar disorder, which is a different thing than struggling with your art and your collaborators if you're disagreeing with them. So, but now I don't think Hollywood has needs the way it's evolved. They don't really hassle with difficult actors very much. I mean, that still exists, but much on a much smaller level, and movie stars have changed. There aren't the movie stars of yore who had that gravitas. And I think, you know, when you talk about 80s movie stars, 70s and 80s movie stars, I feel like that was the last of those movie stars.
Yeah,
movie stars are a lot blander now. They're a lot, you know, they, I mean, and that's not to say there aren't some who surprised me. Like Channing Tatum, when I first saw that guy, I was like, really? This, but he's actually good.
No, look, you can be a bland outward personality, and some of that may just be your own marketing. You're wanting to stay out of tabloids, not wanting to answer questions. You know, John Cusack, who I think, I mean, he seems like away from a camera, he's nothing if not interesting. He goes out of his way to let you know nothing about his personal life.
Right.
So, I mean, John Cusack's been around since like the early 80s. Most people don't know a thing about him.
Well, he's another guy who, if you talk about like the first part of his career,
right,
that would be something. I mean, he was young and I'm old at this point, but if I could have the 42-year-old version of his early career, I mean, and now like he pops up and stuff and it's fun. He does a lot of these terrible direct-to-video movies that I don't understand, but you know, even like in something as dumb as 2012, I was like, that's a brilliant casting choice. He is an everyman. And he's very just instantly relatable.
Yeah, he's
and
good
you put
in
him in ludicrous situations.
He's good, actually ludicrous situations. He's actually pretty, I thought, pretty good. I forgot the name of the movie. The one in the haunted hotel with him and Sam Jackson.
Oh, yeah. Like room, 1408.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's room 1408.
Yeah, yeah.
It's absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's good in it.
Yeah, he's very good in it. Yeah, and I think, I mean, and he's not bad in these direct-to-video movies. It's just a lot of them have you know, level of incompetence by their makers that just doesn't make it work. But like it was great to see him in Hot Tub Time Machine.
Looks so great.
And as much as I love Adam Scott and will be happy to see Hot Tub Time Machine 2 with Adam Scott instead of John Cusack, I wish John Cusack was in it.
Putting in Cusack, I mean, beyond the fact that Cusack was funny and, you know, he's, I think, a really good actor and in particular, a very good comedic actor. When you're casting John Cusack, an 80s icon, in a movie that takes you back to the 80s, there's that extra layer.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's Cusack commenting on his own career.
Right.
And commenting on, you know, what makes him in his own right kind of an icon.
Right.
And it's just, it's different with Adam Scott. And I like Adam Scott too, but it's not the same thing.
No, it's not. But I mean, I heard, and I don't know if this is true, this is just like grapevine gossip, but I heard that he had a lot of trouble with the improv and he felt like he was being
up Cusack?
There. Yeah, Cusack. So there was like a, because I mean Corddry walked away with Hot Tub Time Machine.
Yeah.
I mean that's Corddry's movie. But I like I as an actor, regardless of where I am in a thing, if somebody's like turning in a performance like that, it's awesome just to be around it and serve it on some level. But from what I heard, Cusack's ego kind of got in the way because he wasn't the one stealing all the scenes.
It's just interesting knowing you the way I know you. It feels fitting that you would initially have picked Keaton.
Like, right,
I feel,
right.
I feel, I'm looking forward to that Birdman movie, by the way.
Yeah, I am too.
I really
see that. Yeah, yeah.
I love Keaton. I mean, I feel like he's been underutilized, like I said, kind of misunderstood in Hollywood for a long time. And I think he's awesomely talented.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Last thing I wanted to get into is a little bit about movies. And this is not a wholly singular original thought of mine, although because I've seen it discussed, but I've thought of it before. I started seeing a lot of articles about it. It being 2014, it's the 15-year anniversary of 1999. And a lot of people, and I'd thought about this, like I said, for a while, well before the article started coming out, have felt like 1999 was the last really great year for movies.
Uh-huh.
And
what came out in 99?
I'm going to read you some of the movies that came out then. Toy Story 2. This is going through the Rotten Tomato meter.
Uh-huh.
Toy Story 2, Iron Giant, The Insider, All About My Mother. I don't even remember what that is. Three Kings, The Straight Story, Being John Malkovich, Election, The Limey, Run Lola Run, American Beauty, American Movie, Go, Galaxy Quest, Blair Witch, The Matrix, Buena Vista Social Club, The Sixth Sense, Boys Don't Cry, Magnolia, Talented Mr. Ripley, The Hurricane, the Denzel movie, I assume, Fight Club, Notting Hill, Green Mile, Bowfinger, the South Park movie, Office Space, even some movies that like I thought Eyes Wide Shut was a train wreck.
Yeah, I would say probably a third of the titles you listed I think are massively overrated.
But you know what though, like American Beauty, for example, I know you hate the movie.
I don't like.
I hate the movie too, yeah. But a studio system that would make a movie like American Beauty,
right.
I'm happy for. Even if I don't think the movie is that good. Because a movie like American Beauty
mm-hmm.
doesn't really get made anymore. And it feels like they're rare, and it feels like studios have no idea what to do with them, particularly how to market them. Like, a movie like American Beauty, if it got made now, the odds of it actually being the hit that American Beauty was in 1999 feel impossible.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Or like, you know, Blair Witch Project, regardless of what you think of it now. Back then, I mean, it created a template. You know, American Pie.
An awful, awful, awful template.
But at the time, though, it was something different. It was creative at the time.
Sure, sure, at the time. Like, but it was a gimmick movie that created a subgenre of movies that I think are almost entirely unwatchable. And I mean, they constantly, like, they did it this year with they took E.T. and made it a found footage movie. It's like,
right.
Like, this is the worst. You guys are the worst. It's like, you're making a low budget version of a great movie and calling it original because you're shaking the camera around. It's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I hated when it came out, American Pie. I didn't think it was very good. I didn't see what the big deal about it was.
Mm.
But when you look at what came afterwards and, you know, the crap that, you know, became American Pie light, you can look back on it and say, all right, you know what, at least that was a different way at the time to present a teen movie.
And yeah, that's
just,
true.
There was the element of doing something different, consistent in a lot of these movies. Like, you know, I know a movie we both love, Three Kings.
Yeah.
It feels harder to imagine a studio making that movie. It's not impossible, but it feels harder to imagine.
Yeah, that's true.
Or like, you know, the Sixth Sense, you know, I mean, regardless of what you think of M. Night,
I think The Sixth Sense is a dumb movie, but
yeah, I liked it. I actually did like it.
You know, my wife loves it. She still watches it.
But you know, that sparked in it, you know, not just his career, which really went downhill.
What are you talking about? The Happening is an American film classic.
God. His movies get worse and worse and worse.
To the point where the studios no longer put his name above the title.
It's amazing.
Because they know people won't see it. Which is hilarious. That's like one thing I do not understand about the studio system. We really live in an age of failing up. Like, they will give, I mean, granted, Man of Steel was a gigantic hit, which is depressing to me, because it's really a bad movie. But they gave it to Zack Snyder, who fucked up another DC property in Watchmen, which didn't do well, you know, and he clearly didn't make a good movie. Maybe that movie wouldn't have done well if he'd done it right. But, like, you get to keep failing up. And they keep giving M. Night Shyamalan, like, he made After Earth.
Yeah.
They keep giving him money, like, and stars keep aligning themselves with him.
People say all the time with the industry, once you're in, it's much harder to fall out. I mean, like, you really got to screw up.
Well, there were times, I mean, it's like, take Speed 2 Cruise Control. You know, it took Sandra Bullock a long time to get back on her feet.
But she kept working, though. She kept getting above the title.
And I think that movie, like, killed Jason Patrick's career.
It did not help.
And the truth is that kind of, you know, bomb phenomena. Because it used to be, the guy who directed The Deer Hunter.
Oh, Cimino.
Cimino, yeah. And then his next movie tanked, and then he was done.
Yeah.
The guy who directed The Deer Hunter never recovered after one bomb.
Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, after one bomb. So now a guy's got to have a string of 10 huge budgeted bombs before they're a pariah. That doesn't make sense.
Well, I think it gets back to, like we were talking about earlier, the aversion to risk.
I know, but I see what you're saying, but
I'm not justifying it. No, I'm saying I think this is what it is.
But when you think about it, I see what you're saying, but when you think about it, it's like being risk averse. You're not taking a risk. You're guaranteeing yourself failure.
Well, it's because you want to be able to justify. I mean, every time M. Night gets hired, I guarantee the guy who has to explain to his boss why this movie tanked, he brings up Sixth Sense. Brings up Sixth Sense, and then he brings up Signs, and Unbreakable did reasonably well, right?
Yeah, that's Unbreakable movie. I really liked.
But, I mean, he'll bring up Signs. He'll bring up the star that was... I mean, you know, everything becomes about the fault other than the choice I made.
Right.
And, you know, and look, Hollywood can get weirdly risk-averse, you know, when they'll take a guy who's made only, like, two movies, both of which had, like, a combined $4 million budget... and then give him $175 million to make some Marvel film.
Right,
I mean, they get weird about that, too. And I'm sure, to some degree, they do that because that director doesn't have the clout to stand up to a lot of these execs. And then the execs get to take control of the movie and eventually ruin it.
Right, right, sure.
And then they can blame it on, well, this director didn't have the experience.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I mean, I guess there's a lot of pre-packaging that happens, you know, before the movie is even being written. And that's how all those names wind up coming together.
Now, the names that I read to you, the titles from 1999,
mm-hmm.
even if you only liked a third of them, the overall strength of those movies, or the overall representation of them, however you want to put it, do you think that they represent a film industry in better shape than 2014, worse, or the same?
That's a good question. I mean,
because I think it's far better than.
I think the variety of those titles, whether I liked them or not. I mean, like, I think there's things to admire about American Beauty. You know, I mean, it's a movie that I didn't like. But
I didn't like it either.
It's not an exercise in incompetence or anything like that. I just think it's...
That was an exercise in indulgence.
Yeah,
not,
I think
not
it's very self-indulgent and pretentious.
I think Mendez is often like that as a director, period.
Yeah, I agree. But the variety, the cross-section of stuff that came out that year,
you liked it or not, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and there's a lot less variety.
Especially
now,
when you take into account that a lot of those movies were studio films.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but a lot.
Well, the studios are, yeah, you're right. I mean, because the studios now, I mean, it's like everything is a young adult novel turned into a movie or a comic book turned into a movie.
Right.
Like the vast majority of stuff. There's just not a lot of variety.
What level of confidence, if any, do you have that the studio system and that Hollywood can bounce back, if not to that level, somewhere, you know, moderately good in between.
Well, I think...
Because this matters to you. Movies matter to you.
Yeah, that's true. Luckily, I think there are still independent movies. And like, I just saw this movie. It was really weird, but I kind of liked it. Partially because it was Nick Cage acting again.
Joe,
yeah. I like that. And I think there are things that happen, like...
And that director, by the way, I mean, talking about somebody who is sort of navigating with one foot in the studio system, one foot out, all of his movies haven't worked, Gordon Green or whatever his name
is.
Yeah. But he's had an interesting career.
And yeah, that's the guy and there are guys Highness. Like that. And the guy who directed, like, The Station Agent and Win Win from a couple years ago, he's interesting indie guy. And I have hope there. And I think – but I think with the studio system, because it's so corporate now. I mean, it's like the evolution of corporations and the corporate takeover of the world. It's not just Hollywood, but Hollywood is an example of that. It's really going to take – a major foundation shaking. Like, you know, it happened. The 70s is the result of Hollywood being fucked.
Yeah.
Not making any movies. Like, nobody wanted to see any more goddamn beach blanket bingo movies. And that was their, you know, cash cow. And then people just stopped going to the movies because they sucked. They sucked. And then Hollywood just was like, what do we do? Well, let's give some money to this crazy guy who made this thing called Mean Streets and see what happens. And we'll give it to this crazy
Hal
guy.
Hal Ashby and all these. I mean, it became the age of the director.
Right, exactly. And the auteur, you know. And they gave him not, like, giant budgets, but they gave a bunch of different auteurs control and smaller budgets. And I think that's what leads to more interesting fare.
Well, I mean,
box office.
You know, our friend Steve Falk, you know, he has his show that you've been on.
Yes.
You're a regular recurring character. You're the worst on FX. That's the way he always describes FX, you know, working for FX. And, you know, he really loves working for that network. Budget-wise, you know, whether you're talking the money he's going to make versus working at, you know, NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, it's not as big, but the control he has over his show is so much better than if he was working at one of the big four networks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he gets to call the shots, and he doesn't have people breathing down his neck and making him change his...
The show that I used to have at ESPN, our podcast, we had Sean Ryan on a couple times, and Sean Ryan, he created, among other things, The Shield for FX.
Yeah.
He's raved about working at FX. I've heard the guys from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia talking about just raving all for that same reason. You get to do what you want.
Well, I think FX, you know,
I think it's great.
For my money, is the most interesting. And I'm including the pay channels here. I mean, I think FX has surpassed HBO as like artistically interesting.
Completely agree.
And I didn't even notice that at first because like networks and cable, there's so many fucking channels, which is why they have their stupid logos at the bottom of the screen, so you eventually remember what channel
you're watching.
But like, I realized after a certain point, I was like, "Holy shit, I'm watching a lot of FX shows! Like,
great.
A lot of FX shows.
They're great.
Yeah,
Fargo
they're
was fantastic.
Yeah, Fargo is great, and I'm a big Justified fan.
I love Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, Sons of Anarchy is fun. Even their lesser fare, like I think The Strain is kind of dumb, but it's entertaining dumb.
Right.
So when they go dumb, there's still enough artistic.
They
shit
rarely
happening.
Make something where you go, I don't even that show Partners with Kelsey Grammer, Martin Lawrence feels incredibly out of character for FX.
Yeah, that's like what?
But it speaks to the quality of what they generally do.
That's
even
true.
The stuff that doesn't work as well, like the ambition in doing it.
Right, right. Yeah, because that's what networks are doing now with their sitcoms. They're taking older stars and then jamming them, like recognizable names, and jamming them in a show. And that's not normally what FX does. What's great about You're the Worst is they launched this whole show and there's not a single star in it.
No.
I mean,
I think, outside of television's Todd Robert Anderson.
Except for me, yeah, I'm huge. But they, you know, and I think all – I think all four of the series regulars and then a lot of the supporting cast will break out of this thing.
No, but I mean, the most recognizable face of that show is probably the woman who plays your wife.
Janet Varney is,
And she's not a huge star. I mean, she's worked for a long time.
She works all the time.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, she's probably the most recognizable face of that cast.
Yeah, probably. And some of the guest stars. This is like old school television, because television used to make stars. It used to make movie stars.
Right.
But now all the movie stars are doing television.
Yeah.
So this is like old school in that sense, in that this is the kind of show that is like the breakout role for these people who aren't famous. And then the next thing you know, they're making actually interesting, cool movies.
Okay. Last part, rapid fire. Don't think about any of these too long.
All right.
All-time favorite drama movie.
Oh, all-time favorite drama movie. Jeez. That's a hard...
Don't think!
All right.
No thinking!
Drama, I guess... The Music of Chance.
Okay, that's good. That's
okay.
good. That's
all
a good
right.
choice.
Okay, thanks.
Favorite comedy?
Favorite comedy of all time?
Yes!
Oh, God.
Damn it, don't think.
Yes, and.
I'm Del Close.
You know what? I'm going to say Hot Tub Time Machine.
Okay, there you go.
I keep watching it.
There you go. Favorite horror movie?
Favorite horror movie is...
You're dropping the ball.
John Carpenter's The Thing.
Okay, favorite actor?
Favorite actor of all time?
Yes.
Kurt Russell.
Yes, I love that because it was honest. Favorite actress?
Favorite actress of all time? Famke Jamke.
Least favorite actor of all time?
Least favorite actor of all time?
Nobody's going to hold you to this. Come on.
Oh, God. Least favorite actor of all time would be... I don't know. God.
Can even be someone from Copperview, our old theater company.
least favorite actor of all time. Jesus Christ. I don't know. Al Pacino.
Least favorite actress.
No, let me change it to Robert De Niro.
Okay.
But that's only because he turned.
I know. It's fine. You don't have to justify it. This is you.
Okay. Least favorite actress.
Yes.
That would be...
Could still be De Niro.
I'm going to say Tara Reid, who I mentioned before.
And first movie you loved?
The first movie I loved was Star Wars.
Okay. And Fiend.
Oh, nice one.